Welcome to Dialogue on WUOT. I'm Claire Heddles. Today's episode, unpacking Tennessee's new education laws and imagining a more equitable future. We're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel of the COVID pandemic, but the long-term impact of COVID on classrooms in Tennessee have yet to be seen. Tennessee's General Assembly spent a week in January passing new laws aimed to address both current and anticipated impacts of the pandemic. And I have some amazing experts and advocates on the show today to help me unpack these new laws and imagine what a more equitable education system would look like both during and after the pandemic. So first we have Jeannie Pupo-Walker, the State Director for the Education Trust in Tennessee. She's also a longtime educator and a current school board member for Metro Nashville Public Schools. She formerly worked at Conexión Américas, leading advocacy efforts to improve educational outcomes for Latinos in the state. So Jeannie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Claire. It's great to be here.
And also on the panel is Janae Peterson, the Coordinator of Education and Youth Services at the Knox Area Urban League. The organization has received grants and partnered with statewide nonprofits to develop trainings and provide workshops to advance equity in education, both in Knoxville and across Tennessee. So Janae, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
And we also have Dr. Dorian McCoy, the Associate Department Head of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies and Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of Tennessee. His research focuses on peoples of color experiences in higher education and has been published in more than 20 academic journals and book chapters. So Dorian, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we have Marta Aldridge, the Senior State House Correspondent for Chalkbeat Tennessee, a nonprofit news organization reporting on education. She's a former news person at the Associated Press, and her freelance work has been published in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and other national news outlets. And she started her career at the Knox News Sentinel decades ago. So Marta, welcome virtually back to reporting in Knoxville for this hour.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And if you're listening in, would like to be part of the discussion, you can email your questions to wuotnews@utk.edu. You can send them on Facebook or Twitter at WUOTFM, or you can call into the show at 865-974-5050. So Marta, I want to turn to you first to give us a rundown of last month's legislative session. Can you summarize the biggest changes coming out of the new laws that were passed in January?
Sure. So four main things. Lawmakers voted to hold Tennessee teachers, schools, and districts harmless from the results of state tests that are scheduled for this spring, as long as at least 80% of their students participate in those tests. Second, they approved a 2% funding boost toward teacher salaries this school year, retroactively from January 1st through the end of the fiscal year on June 30th. Third, they voted to require school systems to adopt phonics-based reading instruction and to revise what aspiring teachers must learn in their college training programs about how to teach reading. And lastly, they authorized new summer school and after-school tutoring programs to begin this summer and fall to help students catch up from learning they may have lost because of disruptions to school caused by the pandemic. Now, that learning recovery bill also includes a controversial provision that will increase the likelihood of schools holding back more students who aren't considered proficient in reading by the end of third grade. But those new retention requirements won't start immediately. They'll kick in beginning with the 2022-23 academic school year. And students could retest or take advantage of the new summer and tutoring programs to avoid being retained.
And Jeannie, I'm wondering if you can respond a little bit to that legislation. How much do you think that legislation is going to help making a more equitable school system during the pandemic? And then what else is needed moving forward?
I think, you know, like so many things, the devil's in the details. These were bills that were passed really quickly without testimony or commentary from experts, educators. And so I think a lot of questions remained unanswered in terms of how districts will implement these different, really large-scale projects. And they include everything from how you teach, how you train teachers, what you use to teach reading, to how you use time in the summer and after school, and how you measure student progress. So just a many, many questions. I think for districts, we think about all of the sort of information we're going to need to do, have to do this well. And that includes testing, whether that's formative testing and summative testing, OT and ready testing information, how we place kids in interventions in the summer and after school. So I think, you know, I think the intent is the right one. I think the objectives are the right ones. I think it's really going to come down to how we align resources, support staff to do this work successfully, keeping in mind that teachers are just completely stretched thin right now. And so how do we support them, provide, you know, additional supports, whether it's through college tutors or whether it's community partners. I just think there's a lot of work that has to be done in the coming months to answer those questions.
And on a local level, Janae, what do you hear from students involved in Auxiliary Urban League's youth programs about what would make their schools better, both during the pandemic and afterwards?
Yeah, so one of the main things that our students talk about is just a desire for there to be, I guess I would say, more robust curriculum. There's a desire for them to be able to learn about African-American history in their schools versus, you know, having to learn about it from organizations like ours or researching on their own. And so that is something that I hear echoed often, that they wish there was more curriculum about them as Black students and other people of color in the curriculum. And then additionally, students also have talked about, especially when they are a minority voice in a majority setting, that they don't feel their voice and their opinion is valued. They don't feel that their teachers and even sometimes their peers, other students, that they really respect their thoughts and their ideas about things. And so they wish that was different as well, that, you know, it's not fair for their voice to be disregarded and ignored or looked over. And so those are two of the things that I think about immediately that our students have voiced concern about.
And Dorian, maybe I'll turn to you for a minute. In what ways have you seen this shift to digital learning during the pandemic impact equitable access to higher education?
I think it affects people in ways that many in the majority culture don't consider. And in this instance, I'm speaking more from a class standpoint. People don't think about the absence of technology, meaning they may not have internet access. It took a pandemic for Knox County schools to become one-to-one. So for school districts that are not one student and one computer, how does that affect them? Those are significant. You have to think about privacy issues, safety issues. Having access could harm people in other ways that we may not think about. I think about our undocumented students and their concern about being on screen and who could be at home because they're worried about what could happen if they're recognized by someone. So I think there's often the unknown or the unintended aspects of policy that may seem good or well-intended, but has an adverse effect on people who are minoritized or disenfranchised.
And one thing that's been brought up a lot during these policymaking sessions is this idea of learning loss. And I want to turn to a question that I received from a listener named Carolyn, who sent us an email, and she wrote, quote, "The governor keeps using learning loss as a justification for his policy changes and for pressure to return to face-to-face learning." She's asking, has he ever explained how one measures learning loss? And she wrote, "I believe this is a scare word." So I'm wondering if maybe, Marta, you could respond to this idea of how learning loss is being used to advance policy and how it's being measured in the state.
Well, I think some very generalized terms have been used that perhaps could be misleading. Most of the early references to early loss from our state officials have been based on projections that are based on pre-pandemic data. So they were not, those early discussions were not based on actual tests that were taken this year to assess how much students have lost. Now, districts have been administering their own assessments throughout this year to try to determine that, and they are finding some data on that. But again, until the state's annual assessment this spring takes place, we won't really have that broad statewide data that shows just how much students have fallen behind.
And I'll open to our other panelists. Would any of you like to address this sort of question of learning loss that this listener is asking about?
I can speak to that a little bit. I think sometimes it's a matter of semantics. I mean, I think Marta's absolutely right. We don't have good information on if students have lost ground on literacy, on math, on any given topic. Sometimes it's referred to as lost instructional time, meaning there is less instruction happening each day, depending on the district and how they're delivering instruction in person or not. I mean, not in person, but synchronously, asynchronously. I think also kids who are missing days, or even kids who are checked in, like they're logged on, but they might be helping siblings at the same time. They might be doing multiple things at once. I know for a fact there are high schoolers that are working during the day while they're logged in to school. And so even if you're attending per se, you're not truly in the best possible learning environment. So I think what we're gonna have to decide is what are the metrics we're gonna use that provide confidence, right? For parents, for educators that are meaningful for taking next steps. And I think, you know, these formative, like the tests we give along the year that our kids are taking from home, we don't know how much parents are helping. We don't know what that environment is like at home for them. So there's just a lot of questions around how reliable, how valid a lot of these assessments are going to be for the time being.
Mm-hmm. Claire, if I could just jump in right behind Jeannie. I'm looking at the Stop Learning Loss, which is Senate Bill 7002 and House Bill 7004. And it talks about after school learning mini camps, learning loss bridge camps, and summer learning camps. I co-direct a summer institute at UT for students at Austin East and Fulton High School. And one of the concerns our participants, we refer to them as scholars, have is if I come to you for a week, I lose money. So for students from underserved or low SES communities, summer is a prime time for employment. If they're required to go to quote unquote a camp, how does that adversely affect them financially?
You're listening to our education episode of Dialogue, Unpacking Tennessee's New Education Laws and Imagining a More Equitable Future. I'm Claire Heddles, and I'm joined virtually by Jeannie Pupo-Walker, State Director for the Education Trust in Tennessee, Janae Peterson, Coordinator of Education and Youth Services at the Knox Area Urban League, Dr. Dorian McCoy, Associate Department Head of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Tennessee, and Marta Aldrich, Senior Statehouse Correspondent for Chalkbeat, Tennessee. And if you have questions for our panelists, you can email them to wuotnews@utk.edu, or you can call us at 865-974-5050 to ask on air. So I want to start local for a minute. A recent report from the Commission on Children and Youth found Knox County had one of the highest suspension rates in the state. And on top of that, Knox County schools found Black students are overrepresented in disciplinary action, resulting in suspensions. So Janae, I'm wondering if you can speak for a minute about what's being done on the local level to combat one aspect of inequity, being that unequal discipline outcomes for students of color.
So here in Knoxville, there is a Disparities in Educational Outcomes Task Force, and it was established back in 2014, and one of its goals and the purpose of it is to address the disproportionate discipline outcomes that we see in Knox County that could be a direct result of income, race, language barriers, that kind of thing. And so they have been doing a lot of work to address that specific issue, and specifically there is a discipline plan here in Knox County that kind of takes a proactive approach to discipline. And so they focus on prevention, consequence, and then restoration. And so I do think there has been some significant strides that initiative has made. And although, you know, it is true that Black students are still the highest number of students that we see suspended. I think it's important to note that there is a downward trend, especially if you look just from 2019, 2020 to this current school year. There's a significant decrease in the amount of suspensions we're seeing. And, you know, some might say that is a result of COVID, you know, and there being students going in person or virtually, which is possibly true. But in Knox County, the majority of our students, even just last semester, were in person. And so I think that's important to note that we're aware of the problem and there are efforts being made to address it.
And Jeannie, I want to turn to you for a minute because one of the primary goals of the Tennessee Alliance for Equity in Education, which you're a part of, is to increase educator diversity. Can you talk a little bit about why that's important to you and the organizations that you're a part of?
Absolutely. I do want to touch quickly on the discipline issue really quickly, if you don't mind. One of the things we're going to take on in this legislative session is try to get a ban on corporal punishment. A lot of people don't realize Tennessee still has many, many counties that allow corporal punishment and actually use corporal punishment. There are children paddled in schools across Tennessee every day as young as kindergartners and students with disabilities. And so I believe a bill will be brought forward this session on that issue. And we just think Tennessee can lead the way on this. Almost every state in the South still permits it. And so we just think it's time to move forward. And that includes, you know, using restorative justice and other alternatives to physical harm as a form of, you know, punishment. And so just something to pay attention to, I think, going forward. So in terms of teachers of color and leaders of color, it's a central issue for our alliance that we launched recently, but it's also something that I think many folks across the country and certainly in Tennessee know is an important sort of lever for meaningful change. We know from lots of research that all students benefit when you have a diverse teaching workforce, that many times we know from lots of evidence that students of color who have teachers of color tend to be put into honors and advanced classes more quickly, that those doors are opened more, are usually they're much more likely to be on track for college and be helped to get through into college. And so we also know that in general, it is just good to have different perspectives on a faculty in terms of approaching a whole host of issues, whether it's around curriculum, instruction, school climate. We also know that teachers of color are less likely to be tapped for leadership opportunities. They have to step forward and really push more often than their peers do. We sometimes call that the sort of the racial tax that teachers, particularly bilingual teachers, teachers of color are given, where they have additional duties placed on them, whether that's translating, whether that is dealing with a child who is perceived as a discipline issue. But teachers of color bring so much more to the environment of a school environment than people understand. And so it's just something that I think school leaders, superintendents recognize as something of value. And I think we just have to be very intentional about getting those numbers up.
And Dorian, as a scholar of education policy, your research, what has your research shown about how education diversity or lack of diversity among educators impacts experiences for students of color, both in higher education and in schools at all ages?
Well, from a research standpoint, it shows that diversity education is still needed. There's an absence of cultural competency, both at the K-12 and in post-secondary education. From a student perspective, particularly as they matriculate into higher education, they still experience various isms, whether it's racism, sexism, homophobia, transgenderism, they experience some type of ism. They're still marginalized, isolated. And all of this, it may or may not affect their access, but it definitely affects their retention in higher education. Because when they don't see and engage with people like them or who have a level of cultural competency, they do not frame their experience as welcoming/inclusive. Unfortunately, what happens is there's a majority or majoritarian narrative that we just don't need to talk about some of this. And if we didn't talk about it, things would be better. That's a myth. Reality is, when I walk into a room, you assume I am male, and you assume I am Black, because those are two identities that I hold. And automatically you make some assumptions based on those identities. So at all levels, we need to do more around education, helping people to acquire that cultural competency that will help them better work and engage with not only the students, but their parents, their guardians, and the community in general.
And I want to turn to a listener question for a minute. That's a bit of a turn, but I think also connects. She is asking, how can standardized tests be administered and considered meaningful during a pandemic year after so many students' academic experiences have been disrupted? So maybe, Marta, you can speak a little bit about standardized testing and the impact that it's having in the future based on the new legislation.
Well, I think because it's a pandemic year is the reason that legislation was passed to hold teachers, schools, and districts harmless for the results of those tests. At the same time, because it is a pandemic year, and because we know that students likely have fallen behind, policymakers and researchers see it as more important than ever to administer those tests in order to gauge just where we are, so that we can use that data to inform decisions going forward.
And I'll open that question to our other panelists too, maybe Janae or Jeannie, if you have a comment on the reliability of standardized testing going forward.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's important for us to have the numbers so that we're able to see the impact, but I think that has to be coupled with the understanding of the circumstances and, you know, just being more understanding, more lenient, you know, because of the impact that this entire year has had on students, has had on educators, has had on everyone. And so I think there just has to be a balance there, but it is, I believe, very important for us to be able to see what the impact has been.
And I guess in a follow-up question, I'll ask you, what sort of trainings, workshops, or tools do you think are most valuable for schools or teachers that want to produce more equitable outcomes for their students?
Yeah, I think we've touched on a lot of them. Dorian mentioned just a second ago cultural competency, and I think that is extremely important. I believe that, you know, when you think of this idea of competency, specifically culturally, you first have to identify who you are as a person and understand what your beliefs are and how you relate to others. And then when those ideas that you have about other people or those assumptions that you might make that he referenced earlier, you have to realize that that might be problematic and be willing to do the work to change those beliefs and those ideas that you have. And so I believe it's extremely important to understand simply the students that you work with and understand what their culture is, how they think, why they might do things a certain way. It's important for you to be as effective as you can as an educator. And then also because of the pandemic and just the impact that it has had across the board, I think trauma-informed practices is another training that we need to push for our educators. And just understanding the individual, you know, the student as an individual, understanding the stressors that they might be under because they may have had a family member who died because of COVID, the stressors that they have because it might be a student who has to be parent, you know, to his or her younger siblings. And so I think it's important to, you know, consider that and be trauma informed so that you can be the best that you can be in reaching your students.
And Jeannie, in your years as an education advocate, what do you see as some of the biggest hurdles in Tennessee to producing more equitable experiences and equitable outcomes for students?
You know, what we call, and the work that EdTrust does, is we call this a sort of a fundamental issue of resource equity. And when I say resource equity, I mean there are multiple dimensions to what we think are necessary ingredients for a student to have, be equipped to really graduate and be prepared for their next step. Central to that, of course, is funding, and adequate and equitable funding. And so, you know, as you know, that's a longstanding debate in Tennessee about how schools are funded, at what rate, how money is allocated, that, you know, obviously is being litigated literally as we speak. And so funding is a longstanding equity issue across the country. It's, you know, it's based on the tax base that you have in your community. It's based on the will of a community to allocate a significant portion of their budget to education. So that's a big dimension of it. A second one really is around having really high quality and a diverse teaching workforce that are really well prepared, well trained, well supported, resourced well, paid well, given high quality preparation and training that is really evidence-based, that are provided with really strong curricular materials and up to sort of date kind of training is another big one. I think another one too is all these sort of other pieces that undergird a child's trajectory. One of those is access to high quality early learning in pre-K. We know students of color, low-income students, less likely to have a strong pre-K experience, which sets them up for success in kindergarten, which is why we see kids walk in the door in kindergarten already having gaps in knowledge and learning. And then there's, you know, the whole range of things that I think are seen as optional, like nice to have, not need to have things, which is around social emotional support, all of that mental health support, the school climate pieces, the discipline pieces that really equip students to be ready to learn, frankly, if they are learning in an environment that sees them, acknowledges them, supports them holistically, they're much more likely to be better students. And so as a teacher, there's a saying that, I'm not going to hear what you say until you are listening to me, basically, and until you see me fully. And that relationship piece is as important as your expertise in your content area. And so being able to build meaningful relationships with students and having really high expectations for every single one of them is the critical ingredient.
And Dorian, I want to turn to you if you can comment a bit on some of the things that Jeannie's talking about and how to unequal funding impact learning outcomes in elementary schools, middle schools, and higher education.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the property tax issue, how schools are funded. It goes toward real estate and where people live. I think about my experience and what my realtor knew about me when we moved to Knoxville and what we said and what we were looking for in a home and a school. And the houses we saw and the houses we didn't see, meaning which neighborhoods we visited. We have to take all of that into consideration. But, you know, redlining is a bad word, right? But does that still happen? Probably so. Inequity in property taxes. I mean, if there's no commercial districts in a school zoning area, what does that do for that particular school? If I'm allowed to, very quickly, I'd like to follow up on something that both Janae and Jeannie said, and they were talking about cultural competency in education. I want to offer a challenge to our listeners who might be educators and policymakers. If you're engaging in cultural competency education, what does that look like? Okay. And when I ask that question, I'm asking, does it look safe for you? Because if you're not being challenged, you're not growing. And what happens with many of our school districts, and I've experienced this personally, they don't want educators, consultants, or outsiders coming in challenging them because of external influences they may experience. Politics, school board members having an agenda, et cetera. So when we're engaging in this cultural competency education, what does that look like? In what ways are our teachers being challenged? Because if we don't challenge how they've been socialized, they're not going to unlearn what they've learned. And that's really, really important. Because when we look at what we're talking about, again, the intent of the policies are great, but even going back to the summer camps, it could have an adverse effect on students in other ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And Marta, I'll turn to you for a minute on that funding piece that we were talking about as well, Because I know you wrote a story this morning in Chalkbeat about the current funding debate and how race and politics and power are all at play. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the funding debate that's happening right now when it comes to equal funding for schools.
Well, because of the challenges of reopening classrooms during the pandemic, the two school districts in Tennessee that have stuck mostly to a remote learning option or remote learning completely have been in Memphis and in Nashville. Now, Nashville is beginning to transition this week to offer an in-person learning option, but this has been a drumbeat by Governor Bill Lee that schools need to be offering their families an in-person learning option. And he's been very frustrated, especially with the districts in Memphis and Nashville for keeping remote during this time. There was a legislative proposal that was introduced last month from GOP leadership that would tie school funding to reopening classrooms. And that has been really escalated the rhetoric around the school reopening debate. Funding has always been a challenge in Tennessee. We, even though we've been adding hundreds of millions of dollars to education funding in over the last decade, we still rank toward the bottom in per pupil spending. I think the elephant in the room is the lawsuit that was filed 5 years ago by Shelby County Schools, and then Nashville School Board joined that lawsuit against the state, questioning the adequacy of the state's funding for education. So it's not how the pie is divvied out. Is the pie big enough? That lawsuit is going to be going to trial. It's set for trial for this October after 5 years. So I think, again, that's the elephant in the room. A lot of people are thinking about it. It's on people's minds, even as we begin to resume the legislative session, the regular session next week. And Governor Lee puts forth his spending proposals for the next fiscal year.
You're listening to Dialogue, Unpacking Tennessee's New Education Laws and Imagining a More Equitable Future. I'm Claire Heddles, and I'm joined virtually by Jeannie Pooper-Walker, State Director for the Education Trust in Tennessee, Janae Peterson, Coordinator of Education and Youth Services at the Knox Area Urban League, Dr. Dorian McCoy, Associate Department Head of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Tennessee, and Marta Aldrich, Senior Statehouse Correspondent for Chalkbeat, Tennessee. If you have questions for our panelists, you can email them to us at wuotnews@utk.edu, or you can send them to us on Facebook and Twitter at WUOTFM, or you can call into the show. Our number is 865-974-5050. So Janae, I want to turn to you first and ask you, when it comes to imagining a better post-pandemic education system, what do you hope to see done differently, both on the local level and on the state level?
I think the pandemic has magnified and kind of shed light on issues that already existed. We know that, and simultaneously it has exacerbated those issues and kind of widened gaps that were already in place. And so one of the main issues, again, is something that we've already talked about, but it's technology access. That is something that, you know, we've had many conversations about over the past months, in many students having to transition to virtual education. And so I think about the community that I serve. Many of the students here don't have immediate access to laptops or devices or reliable internet connection that they need, you know, to be able to be successful. And so there have been a lot of I think, short-term solutions that have been put in place, but those are the things that we need to address and make some permanent changes to. You know, we need to make the technology access something that we don't have to question, you know, for all students, and everyone is able to have that same level of access that they need. And so that's something that I think about. Just a lot of the issues that have been uncovered are, you know, have become more prominent because of the pandemic and the emergency kind of sense of urgency that we had in solving those problems short term. We need to have that same sense of urgency in addressing it for a longer span of time. And then one other thing I think about is, you know, mental health and the importance of putting more focus on that social and emotional learning. I think that's an area that has not been talked about enough, but now because of the pandemic, we see the importance of it. We see the impact that it can have on education, on a student's success. And so that's something that I think it needs to remain at the forefront of the conversation going forward.
And Dorian, maybe I'll pose the same question to you. When you imagine a better future moving forward, what do you hope to see in Tennessee and in higher education?
Yeah, this is a complex issue. I would like to see us simply be better than better. We've got work to do. We need to be realistic. We need to understand the disparities. We need to understand who has access, who does not have access, and how that affects individuals. I totally agree with Janae. All COVID has done is illuminate what we already had a sense of. Now we're dealing with it daily because our quote unquote norm has been disrupted. You know, I'm listening to Janae's comments and I was thinking about a panel that I was listening in to in the fall. It's hard for me to understand how we can go online in Knox County schools, yet 20-something percent of the students at the beginning of the school year still had no internet access. We gave them Chromebooks, we're one-to-one, but they can't access their classes. I can't be the only person that finds that problematic. So we've got work to do.
And Jeannie, as someone who's been a longtime education advocate, what can people that are listening, maybe teachers, parents, or students, do to advocate for equity in their own schools?
You know, so I always think that the best advocates are the ones that do their homework. So it's one thing to lift up and say and call out the things that are true, such as lack of access to the internet, you know, all of those things. I think the other half of the coin is, what are the answers? What do we know are potential solutions, right? And then figuring out, you know, in the old advocacy playbook, like, who has the power to make the change? What does your school board member have the power to do? What was the state board of education have the power to do? What is the state legislator have the power to do? What is the governor and the commissioner have the power to do? All of them hold important seats, and they all have different roles to play. So it's really important to become really familiar with who has the power to change something. So if you really want to talk about changing the BEP formula, you're not going to talk to your school board member. You're going to talk to your state legislator, right? If you're going to talk about teacher licensure issues, you're going to talk to your state board member, right? And so it's really important to just know who has power where. Sometimes we call that power mapping. And then the other thing that I think is equally as important is being able to connect your personal story to the issue at hand. If you are a teacher who needs translators in your building, needs mental health specialists in your building, needs access to 21st century technology and all of that, connect the personal story to the policy that is needed. So, you know, I think, or the story of a student. You don't have to even give the name of the student, but a student that is emblematic of the issue you see every day. And then personalizing that issue for a policymaker can be all the difference in the world. And then the last thing I'll say is, some of the very best and most persuasive advocates are students. And so when students are equipped with storytelling abilities, with connecting those dots, with learning how to speak persuasively on an issue, they can move mountains. And so really harnessing the advocacy power of students is another really important tool.
And we just got a question from a listener who said, what is being done to help children with special needs in the state who aren't able to learn virtually? So, Marta, I'm not sure if you have insight on that question based on your reporting on the legislature, or if someone else on the panel would like to answer that.
We have not focused on special ed, so I will defer on that. It is definitely a challenge, and districts are struggling with that. They're doing yeoman's work, but it's a struggle.
I can say that there has not been, like so many aspects of this pandemic and education, there has not been a roadmap for this, right? And so districts are kind of left to their own devices on a lot of these key issues. And so we opened doors to special ed students last semester for, I can't remember how many weeks now, 8 weeks, 10 weeks or something. And even still, only about 30% of our students with the most severe kind of learning disabilities, whether it's physical, handicap, nonverbal, only 30% came. And so there's this combination of parents very worried that an immunocompromised child would get the coronavirus, number one, even though they need that child in an environment where they're getting help, where they're learning, there's opting not to, number one. Number two, Metro National Public Schools, which may not be the case in other places, has opted to not send paraprofessionals and aides into homes during this time because of lots of different reasons, right? The safety of that paraprofessional, of maybe perhaps getting the virus, you know, potential litigation issues, right? You know, a whole host of issues. And in the meantime, we have students who there are some things that cannot be done virtually, just cannot be done. But I will also say that some things can be done, and it's been interesting to see special ed personnel be very creative. And so here you have speech therapists doing virtual sessions, and the parent is sitting in and listening and learning about strategies to support speech therapy or occupational therapy. And so I think people have been creative, but there's only so much you can do, frankly. And so rest assured, parents of disabilities are often the most forceful advocates, students with disabilities in the country, and they have stood up and they have sued already, filed lawsuits across the country on accessing, you know, their rightful sort of services under IDEA.
And we have about 10 minutes left, so maybe I'll ask all of you if you could answer, what have you been most worried about on the day-to-day basis when it comes to the populations that you work with and you serve in terms of education? So maybe we'll start with Dorian.
My biggest concern is access, and what that means for not only minoritized people or students of color, but what that means for the majority culture and how they view that for underrepresented students. So my largest concern is access, which then evolves into what's being done to retain those students once they enter higher education.
And Marta, maybe I'll turn to you either as a reporter or from the people that you talk to in your reporting. What do you see as the biggest day-to-day worries of people in terms of education?
Well, I think right now it's the pandemic, and it's the constant concern of virus spread and these new strains that are coming out. It's concern about it, what it's doing to students. It's concern about what it's doing to educators who are stressed out and exhausted and considering leaving the profession. I think the next few months are just going to be critical. And I think especially for our most vulnerable students, students who are mostly of color, living in poverty, disproportionately affected by this virus. That's what I've got my eye on.
And Janae, I'll turn to you with the same question.
I'm concerned about the impact of the pandemic, specifically on our students' mental health. I mentioned it earlier, but I hear often from students just the immense stress that they are under, the just concerns that they have. And, you know, school for some of our students is an escape, you know, from toxic family situations. And, you know, particularly when, you know, during quarantine, you're in that environment, you're not able to have that that way to escape and get out of that. And so I worry about the effect that it is taking and the long-term impact that we're going to see because of this time. Some of our students that, you know, this time, you know, a year or two ago, were super excited about graduation and going to college. Just in talking to them now, it's very dejected, very, you know, low morale. And so how do we recover from that? And you know, just that's something that heavily concerns me. So that's what I would say.
And Jeannie, I'll turn to you as well. What are your largest concerns based on the populations you work with?
I mean, I think I'll echo what everybody else said. I think there are kids that it will take quite a while to recover from this, right? And it will take sort of families trying to figure out sort of next steps. You know, I've been worried from the beginning about homeless students, students who are, again, living in really unsafe environments. But I'm also flip this and say I'm also hopeful about some innovations that have come out of this because we've been forced to be innovative. And so you see now parent participation in student teacher parent conferences, because they're virtual, is like tripled, right? Parents have access now to engaging with their teacher, their child's teacher. They know their teacher better because they're watching their children online every day. They're learning the language of their teacher, the pacing of a day, the pacing of instruction. All of that, we have to leverage all of that going forward, that parent engagement and understanding and knowledge that they didn't have before. And then the other thing I'll tell you that I'm hopeful about, that I've been talking to folks about, is because we have been one-to-one in Nashville now because of the pandemic, and we've given out hotspots, so kids are connected, we're rethinking the way we do suspension and expulsion, because we can push kids out, which obviously we need to do a lot less of, but when they're not in the classroom, they can still remain engaged virtually. And how do we design something that truly is providing more than just instruction, but also other kind of supports, counseling, all the, you know, group work, like group, you know, counseling. I mean, how can we leverage a Zoom room with kids who are really experiencing a lot of the same things, right? With really talented counselors. And so, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. I worry about our teachers. There's so much on their plate. They're going to be so burned out. These camps in the summer, I just don't know how many are going to sign up to come back to do these camps, full day camps. I hope we can hang on to our teachers and find a way to spread the load in the coming months. But it's just been, and I also have to say, it's been tremendously hard for superintendents and school boards. As a school board member, it's the most stress. It's clearly the most stressful time I've ever had, but as a school board member, nothing more stressful than this school closure period.
And you've been listening to Dialogue, Unpacking Tennessee's New Education Laws and Imagining a More Equitable Future. I'm Claire Heddles, and I want to extend a special thank you to Greg Hill for his assistance in producing this show, and to our incredible panelists for sharing their insight with us this hour. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News on 91.9 FM. This is your NPR news station. We're broadcasting from the campus of the University of Tennessee.